Thank you very much indeed, and it's a real pleasure to be here. The first indication that I had that I might be invited to come to Brazil at this time was a message last May from an economist that I think many of you must know, Gary Dembski, who suggested to me that it would be a good time to come to Brazil and to talk about the crisis, because he thought, given the confluence of events in the United States, Europe, and China, that the bloom would be off the Brazilian rose in December. And given the news of the last several days, it seems to me that looks like a very shrewd prognosis 7 or 8 months in advance. In any event, I appreciate the invitation very much and the opportunity to speak in very broad and general terms about the Great Crisis. It's a topic on which I'm struggling to write a book, and I am not entirely confident that I can convey what is in my mind in a concise and clear way. The problem, in part, is that many of us approach this event through mental and linguistic shortcuts that encapsulate a theoretical framework that we have not troubled to examine. Thus, the events of 2007 and 2008 were a bubble that popped, a meltdown, perhaps a Minsky moment. And the aftermath was a great recession, a larger than normal event in an utterly normal business cycle. In Europe, we hear about a Greek crisis or a public debt, sovereign debt crisis. There has been a collapse of confidence, but with discipline, the markets will return to normal. With fiscal consolidation, there will be economic recovery. This terminology all seems to me to be unsuited to the actual recent history, current conditions, and prospective events. So if we're going to think about matters properly, we need to be very careful, first and foremost, with language. I want also to suggest that a proper theoretical framework for thinking about these events and issues needs to be at the least consistent with physical and biological laws. The concept of trends, cycle, and above all, the concept of equilibrium and the idea that the system returns to that normal condition, these are not biophysically sound ideas. In the world in which we actually live, entropy increases, animals die, species go extinct, companies go bankrupt, countries deindustrialize. System failure is a feature of human history. And one cannot, I think, properly justify an economics that is built around neglect of that possibility. To state a relevant physical principle, it seems to me, in broadest terms, an economic system is profitable, that is to say, it yields a surplus which is can be enjoyed, when it can obtain the resources required to run it at low cost and use them for maintenance and reproduction with high efficiency. In this respect, economic systems that are large have a substantial element of fixed cost typically have advantages. Have scale economies, they have network economies, they can be diversified, they have the capacity to support research and therefore to innovate, they have reserves and liquidity. But at the same time, large systems are necessarily few in number. Being large, you can't have a large number of them. They're relatively inflexible, and they are fragile. They're vulnerable to changing environmental and resource conditions. It's true of countries, it's true of businesses, it's true of animals. The bigger they are, the more dramatic it is when they collapse. So let me, just having offered that very cursory concept of a framework, try to compress 66 years of history into a paragraph. I would argue that the uncontested hegemony of the United States ran from 1945 to 1970 on the strength of strong institutions built up in the New Deal, powerful industries in part built up during the Second World War, cheap energy, major discoveries of petroleum in the United States in the 1930s and then outside in the larger world, and military dominance outside of what was then called the Sino-Soviet bloc. All of this began to unravel around 1970. At that time, oil production in the lower 48 United States came to a peak. We were defeated militarily in Vietnam, and over the course of this period, other major industrial powers were emerging, notably, of course, Germany and Japan. Still, beginning in 1980, the Federal Reserve, under the leadership of Chairman Volcker, and then the U.S. in general under Ronald Reagan, restored the dominance of the country on the world scene, largely on the strength of its financial power in a financially unstable world. That's to say, created an environment in which the relative position of the United States improved dramatically by virtue of the debt crises that were inflicted on much of the rest of the world, including, of course, Brazil at that time. And this, alongside the wave of technological change that followed in the 1990s, brought the United States about another 20 years of continued strength, especially so because the other large but fragile system that existed in the world at that time, that is to say the USSR and its satellites, crumbled first, partly under the strains on that under which it had been placed by U.S. competition. The credit boom that underlay the information technology revolution peaked in the year 2000, in the spring of 2000. And after that, I would argue, there was no straightforward or obvious way to maintain prosperity, high employment, strong economic growth within the American system. So if one wants to date the peak of the previous system, it's probably the turn of the millennium rather than 2007, 2008. That is the relevant turning point. In 2001, and especially in 2003, the U.S. administration under President Bush tested the effects of war, of the application of military power on the American economy. I'm not saying they went to war for economic reasons, but one got a sense of the extent to which putting the country on a war footing would affect economic growth, and the answer to that question was that it doesn't work very well under modern conditions. The economic foundations of a war economy in modern times are exceptionally narrow. It's very unlike what it used to be in World War II or Korea or even Vietnam. And the technology and the global political system have also shifted the advantage decisively to those fighting on their home territory, making the application of military power an exercise in futility. So the wars did not decisively boost the American economy, and yet the pressure to report high rates of return rates of return that had become customary by the past habit, and particularly the experience of the 1990s and the ebullient period when a great many people became rich and a great many more people thought they would become rich, this pressure was still unremitting. And if you were a private company, you still had to satisfy your financial analysts and your Wall Street funders. The notion of a Minsky moment is illuminating, but it does not exactly fit the situation that I'm describing. The Minsky process is one in which stability breeds instability, that is to say, a period of prosperity causes a reach for yield, an effort to get ever higher returns, and therefore to take on ever greater risk. But in this situation, what happened was driven in part by the desire to maintain past yields, which had been very high, and the past economic growth rate, which had been very substantial, both of which had become unsustainable under the changing objective conditions. The problem was not resolved and could not be resolved by reviving the technology sector, which had basically peaked at that point. It could not be resolved in the broader industrial sector, which was remained under enormous pressure from international competition, and certainly not from agriculture. The energy sector in the United States has been in decline for a long time. So it was resolved in housing, or more specifically in housing finance. And here, there was a problem. The United States had been developing its housing industry for a very long time. It was essentially a mature sector. If you were a middle-class household in the U.S., you could get, with good credit, you could get a mortgage loan. And there could not be, in the nature of things, rapid growth to good credits, because there just weren't enough of them who didn't already have the loans that they needed. So the sector that made loans to borrowers who would repay those loans was largely tapped out. What was possible, however, was to have rapid growth of lending to borrowers who would not repay those loans. Right? The market for good loans was saturated, but the market for bad loans is intrinsically unlimited. And of course, the problem with loans that will not be repaid, it's an interesting concept, is that they have to be sold to someone else who will eventually take the loss. That's the nature of that business. That is the business model that's involved here. In this way, since people do not voluntarily assume or make purchases that they know will result in massive financial losses, in this way, financial fraud was an intrinsic and essential element of the scheme that provided economic growth to the larger U.S. economy in the last half of the 2000s. This was facilitated in a very direct way by acts of government, beginning in the 1990s, one could trace it all the way back to the early 1980s, but certainly in the 1990s and the late 1990s, when the Clinton administration, the Democratic administration, repealed the Glass-Steagall Act separating commercial from investment banking, and in 2000, when the same administration passed and signed the Commodity Futures Modernization Act, which legalized unregulated credit default swaps. And then in 2001, in the immediate aftermath of 9/11, the Bush administration deactivated the financial police, taking 500 FBI agents who had previously been assigned to financial fraud, reassigning them to counterterrorism, something which was understandable under those conditions, but was not understandable was that they were never replaced. And appointing in the critical regulatory positions in the Office of Thrift Supervision, the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, at the Federal Reserve under Mr. Greenspan, a body of officials who either ideologically did not believe in the role of government as supervisor and regulator, or who were personal experience closely tied to the industry in question. I spoke earlier about the importance of being careful with language. And I think there is a language to describe the that describes accurately what happened in the housing finance sector in the United States. Mortgages by the millions were originated and sold to people who would not pay them back. This, I think, was effectively a counterfeiting scheme. That is to say, documents that resembled mortgages, that were labeled as mortgages, were created, but they were not, in fact, mortgages. They were documents that were being that partially documented loans made to people who did not report their incomes, who had bad credit histories or no credit histories, against houses that were deliberately inflated, whose values were deliberately inflated by appraisers put under pressure for that purpose. The loans were then, of course, bundled, securitized, and passed to the ratings agencies, who did not examine the underlying documentation and therefore deliberately did not uncover the fact that the underlying loans were massively fraudulent. The ratings agencies were engaged in an activity which is known as laundering. Right? The French word blanchissage is very nice for this. Right? They took a corrupt document and presented it to the public as a AAA security. The banks and the investment banks then sold these documents, these securities, to an investing public in the United States, but around the world. This is an activity which is properly known as fencing. Okay. And of course, to whom? The question, who is going to buy these things? An answer to that question is given quite brilliantly in Michael Lewis's little book, The Big Short. He quotes a market participant saying, so who is buying this stuff anyway? And someone else responds, Dusseldorf. Dusseldorf. Okay? In other words, it was being sold to people who had money and who had the misfortune of believing that their counterparties in the United States banking sector and at the ratings agencies were trustworthy. I don't wish to say quite that fraud caused the crisis. My point is a little broader. It is that fraud was an integral, indispensable ingredient of the phony boom that preceded the crisis. And the prevalence of fraud, which was practically universal in this sector, Fitch Ratings in 2007 conducted a small survey of the documents underlying mortgage-backed securities and discovered there was missing documentation, abuse, or fraud in practically every file. That was not accidental on anyone's part. The authorities who were charged with stopping it were aware, they were warned. The FBI in 2004 stated publicly that the country was facing an epidemic, that was the agency's term, of mortgage fraud, and the officials did nothing. Only, I think, with economists does the question, was it ignorance as opposed to complicity, really come to not have a clear answer. I don't think we can be entirely sure whether the economists who had created the world of kind of a perpetual motion machine of growth and through financial innovation were acting out of a corrupt complicity or a simple naive ignorance. But that's a, as one would say, an academic question. The US crisis was therefore plainly, from the beginning, an exceptional or extraordinary event, particularly in the context of the period since the Second World War. Unlike prior post-war slumps, it was not due to a policy shock or an external shock. It was instead due to the sudden realization by all players in the financial sector that the entire foundation of trust and trustworthiness on which that sector must rely had evaporated, broken down, had vanished, and not temporarily, but in effect permanently. That is why the credit markets froze up, why the interbank lending markets froze up in particular in August of 2007, and why other major markets, the money market funds, the commercial paper market, disappeared and had to be nationalized if they were going to be survive at all. It was also why it was clear that there could plainly be no return to normal, that this was going to be very unlike the standard post-war business cycle, and that the models which were rooted in concepts like a natural rate of unemployment were going to prove to be completely inapplicable to the situation. So I said, in the US, this was clear to many from very early on. The problem was, how do you get the point across in a culture that is wedded to the notion that the economy is a self-correcting structure? In the summer, early summer of 2008, midway between the collapse of Bear Stearns and the bankruptcy of Lehman Brothers, I went so far as to convene a group of 30, I thought, highly reputable specialists, courtesy of a foundation in Paris, in order to spend several days talking over these issues and producing a memorandum, a long memorandum, describing the extent of the crisis and laying out its probable trajectory. And I sent this to the Obama campaign in the early days of July 2008. But it went unanswered and possibly unread. At that point, bankers and people who were accustomed to work closely with the bankers were already in control, and for whatever reason, the views that we were trying to express were not wanted. One consequence of that was that when the crisis became the dominant political event, in September of 2008, and then the election occurred and the Obama team became the transition team, they accepted the previous forecasts of the Office of Management and Budget from the Bush administration, which were forecasts of a limited slump and a relatively rapid recovery, consistent with the concept that a natural rate of unemployment existed, the economy would tend to revert to it over a five-year period, and that what was needed at most was a, quote, stimulus package, that is to say, assistance to the economy to reach its normal condition at a slightly more rapid pace than would be the case without the stimulus package. And if you look back at the technical projections on which the new administration was relying, you find that they're very much imbued with this presupposition. And with that, I would argue, the political fate of the new American administration was sealed. There is nothing worse in politics than forecasting an economic recovery that does not occur. It calls into question both the ideology and the competence of the government. In this case, What it did was to open the way for a blanket rejection of Keynesianism, of the entire supposed intellectual foundation for the use of public spending in support of economic activity, a rejection which has occurred in the United States and which has been accepted largely by both political parties. And has occurred also with the full connivance of economic policy officials, with the result that we have today an obsessive focus on budget deficits and public debt instead of a discussion of employment, economic recovery, and the continued disastrous condition of the financial sector. Meanwhile, of course, there was trouble brewing in Europe. A dollar shortage, which developed very early in the as the crisis unfolded in the wake of the Lehman bankruptcy, was mitigated only by massive swap agreements between the Federal Reserve and the European Central Bank. And banks and other financial entities in Europe, which suddenly faced crippling losses on the toxic assets, on the fraudulent mortgage-backed securities that they had bought from the U.S. financial system, as well as demands for higher capital asset ratios, responded by selling off their weaker sovereign debts. A coordinated credit market event which produced a divergence of yields beginning in early 2009 between the weaker sovereign countries and the stronger ones. And this is what precipitated the common crisis of Eurozone sovereigns, in spite of the fact that the countries immediately involved, Greece, Portugal, Ireland, and Spain, had very different macroeconomic profiles in advance of the crisis. Greece, of course, had has always had a deficiency of tax revenue. In Ireland, it was a matter of a commercial real estate boom. In Spain, a housing boom, and in Portugal, a structural problem of the industrial sector above all. These were very different things, but they became merged in the functioning of the credit system as the banks adjusted by selling off their weaker assets in the response to the pressures that they were under. Greece, in particular, with a freshly elected socialist government, became the convenient symbol and the scapegoat of what was, in fact, not a Greek crisis and not even a European crisis, but the European annex to a global financial crisis. The European situation has proved actually worse than that in the United States, I think for two principal reasons. First is bad economic ideas and institutions, and the second is politics that are toxic even by North American standards, including a complete lack of trans-European solidarity. On the economic side, Europe had the great misfortune, in fact the disastrous misfortune, to have its institutions formed under the influence, under the dominance of neoliberal ideas. That is to say, institutions that were essentially created after decline of the post-war Keynesian consensus, especially the European Central Bank, the bank regulatory system process that has been undertaken in Basel, that relies on this hands-off mechanism of capital requirements, and the absence of automatic fiscal stabilizers that can operate transnationally, that is to say, at the continental scale. Europe continued to have fiscal stabilization at the national level, so that Germany, in fact, is very effective. but at the international level, there was none at all. The trans-Europeans transfers that would have been required to offset the divergent balance of payments positions of the debtor and countries on the one side and Germany on the other simply did not come into existence. So there was no offset except for unsustainable commercial debt for the German current account surpluses that began to grow rapidly with the introduction of the euro in the year 2000 and after. And as I think is not necessarily to dwell on in Brazil, it's obvious that international financial relations cannot be managed at commercial bank rates of interest. Something that was learned here in the 1980s. On the political side, North European leaders, were all too willing to play to their galleries, to their constituencies, who believe, perhaps instinctively, but they also have a somewhat religious element, that surpluses signify virtue and that deficits signify vice, that those who run surpluses are hardworking, competitive, reaping the rewards of their diligence, that those who run deficits are feckless, lazy, lie about in the sun types, and overlooking the fact that Greeks, in fact, work more hours than Germans do. And these are perhaps people who have never been taught that neither deficits or surpluses are possible without the other. One is simply the accounting mirror image of the other in a closed system. And to be fair, even where European leaders may well understand these points, and it would not surprise me in the least to discover that Chancellor Merkel understands it, there is no political case for articulating them in public. Spaniards do not vote in Germany. And this is, of course, a very different situation than we have in the United States, where the debtor class, the population most affected negatively by the crisis, that is to say homeowners, are a very substantial, in fact, dominant force inside the political system. So I would argue that for basically this reason, the United States economy has been stabilized. We have no strategy for a successful economic recovery. We've lost a substantial share of the labor force, has lost employment permanently, and will basically subsist on public assistance and on whatever remaining assets it may have until it reaches the age to go into Social Security and Medicare. But the system is approximately stabilized at relatively low levels of activity and employment. This is in part because we do have very large public deficits which are supporting private incomes. And so while output and employment fell dramatically, incomes did not fall very much. And we also have a policy of effectively zero interest rates, which provides a very low cost of funds, which has been maintaining the banking system in a state of at least suspended animation. Europe, in contrast, is in a mode which I think can reasonably be described as suicidal, with each bailout being perhaps deliberately short of the steps required even to stabilize the banking system, who continue to sell off assets, driving up yields, while the blood price in political terms that is required to justify this recycling of funds is a fearsome policy of austerity, of fiscal cutbacks, and basically the destruction of the welfare state in the southern countries of Europe, countries where the welfare state was never strong by European standards in the first place. It was never strong in Greece, not very strong in Portugal, at where public schools, the public health system, certainly the universities, are in the deepest kind of trouble. If you are a professor with, let's say, 30 years of experience in Greece, you have experienced already a 40% cut in your pay. Your pay in euro terms is comparable to that of someone teaching perhaps high school in the United States at the moment. It's not an environment in which it is possible to maintain institutions of higher learning at the at a world competitive level. Simply not going to happen. And of course, anybody in that position who has an exit option is going to take it sooner or later. And we've also seen what the Europeans politely refer to as a democratic deficit, deepening democratic deficit, as the governments that were elected have been replaced by governments that are effectively appointed by officials in Brussels, in both Athens and Rome. And yet, it continues. The European leadership seems unable or unwilling to change direction, and each step of the policy seems directed to making things worse. I don't think the European Union is doomed. It's extremely difficult to imagine institutionally or legally how countries would exit the Eurozone if they chose to do it, how they could do so successfully without severe transitional problems. But there certainly are questions now about whether it can survive over the long term, and also a question about whether it should. If the purpose of the European Union is not to bring the lower income countries into a closer alignment and greater equality with the higher income countries, if it's not to strengthen institutions but to destroy them, then the question has to be asked, what's the justification for keeping it in place? What's the most likely scenario? I think in the US, the most likely scenario is a continued stagnation evinced by a slow rate of economic growth and very little improvement in employment, although unemployment may fall as people exit the labor force. And the substantial risk to that scenario may come after the next presidential election if it happens to be the case that those who would cut the remaining bulwarks of North American social insurance, Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, if that crowd should win complete control, then it's possible that the United States would follow Europe into a new wave of self-destruction. But I don't think that is the most likely thing at the present time. It could be wrong, and there are people who I respect who think that it is the most likely thing. In Europe, the most likely scenario, it seems to me, is continued decline at a much stronger pace than in the United States, with increasing amounts of civic unrest, already very evident in Greece, in France, in Italy. And that will tend toward the day when there may be an upheaval, especially possibly in Italy or France, which could force a change in political direction. Italy is a very interesting case because it is the country which is too big to be ignored, or too big to be effectively destroyed. And should it develop a government with a distinctly different perspective than the one it has now or the one that was just replaced, then you could see political developments that become quite interesting, but I'm not especially hopeful that that will happen. What lessons should be drawn? I won't dwell on them at length. It seems to me that there are three or four that one might mention here. First of all, is that we should be very grateful for comprehensive, countrywide, continental scale social insurance schemes, that they are and have been a fundamentally important stabilizing force in North America, and their absence has been exceptionally damaging in Europe. Secondly, we learn again that the financial sector always requires autonomous adult supervision. It cannot be allowed to regulate itself any more than any complex system can regulate itself. You don't leave a nuclear reactor without moderators and cooling systems, and you should not leave banks without investigators and regulators and supervisors and prosecutors as necessary. Thirdly, countries that have a resource base, the capacity to adopt conservation strategies and to generally make better use of the of their natural endowments will enjoy a distinct advantage in a resource short world. And I suppose fourthly, that a system of a social framework that maintains an element of political solidarity stands a much better chance of surviving than one which does not. So on those four points, I'll have to say it is very nice to be in Brazil. Even if the bloom is off the rose for the moment, even if the crisis is now being felt here, it's at least possible that a foundation of favorable institutions built up over years now, and of good common sense and the capacity for independent thought about economic matters, can make for a better result in a bad situation. Thanks very much.